A maximum security prison officer once told me something chilling. The scariest inmates aren't the ones who look dangerous. They're the ones who make you forget where you are. Paul embodied this perfectly. With his striking looks and easy charm, he ranked among the most psychopathic 1% of all prisoners, scoring 38 out of 40 on the standard assessment. Yet he moved through the prison like he owned it, and in many ways, he did. Born into a criminal dynasty and trained in the con code from childhood, Paul had worked as a hitman, torturing debtors, eliminating rivals, yet carried himself with the relaxed confidence of someone hosting a dinner party. What made him truly dangerous wasn't his violence, but his surgical precision in manipulating everyone around him. He nearly tricked me into smuggling contraband by making me feel I'd broken a promise I never made. More devastatingly, he seduced Louise, an exemplary prison officer, starting with small favors that escalated from magazines to cigarettes to cannabis until she was completely compromised. Paul understood something fundamental. Manipulation works best when the victim never realizes they're being played. Brain scans reveal psychopaths process the world fundamentally differently. Their prefrontal cortex, our moral compass, shows reduced activation, while the amygdala, our emotional alarm system, displays diminished activity, making them struggle to recognize fear or distress in others' faces. Studies show up to 18% reduction in amygdala volume, but not everyone with these brain differences becomes criminal. Neuroscientist James Fallon discovered his own brain showed the classic psychopathic pattern and carried the warrior gene associated with violence, yet built a successful academic career. The difference? A stable, nurturing childhood. I once mistook Tony for a consultant psychiatrist. Standing in the secure psychiatric hospital in an impeccable suit, he projected calm authority. Only later did I learn he was a patient, a cellophane psychopath, wrapped in a tissue-thin, reflective mask that changed depending on his audience. His con man father, who abandoned the family when Tony was 8, perhaps taught him that identity itself was just another con. Tony maintained bizarre fictions, claiming to have written a 13-volume history of British kings with absolute conviction. His index offense revealed his true nature. After arranging a meeting with a male sex worker for light BDSM, he brutally assaulted the man, then left a check that bounced. What made Tony particularly unsettling wasn't his violence, but his fundamental emptiness. Behind every mask was just another mask, all the way down. In 2014, I discovered a British man convicted of murder in Italy was Jason Marshall, a former patient who'd absconded from my hospital. Born in 1989 to imprisoned, heroin-addicted parents, Marshall's childhood was marked by abandonment. As a teenager, he impersonated authority figures, once posing as transport police with a Yorkshire Terrier as his sniffer dog. After his 2010 prison release, he traveled to Rome and used dating apps to lure victims, attacking Umberto Gismondi and murdering Vincenzo Yale, strangling, stabbing, and robbing him. At trial, he claimed to be the Archangel Gabriel. Evidence later revealed he'd also murdered Peter Fasoli in London, posing as an undercover officer before tying him up, killing him, and setting his apartment ablaze. Video footage showed his seamless deception, lies flowing so naturally he seemed to believe them. This is pathological lying at its extreme. Deception becomes so effortless, the liar forgets actual truth exists. Marshall's underactive amygdala made lying as easy as breathing, revealing someone fundamentally alienated from social accountability. Arthur was so unremarkable, I had to search my notes to remember his name. Short, thin, impossibly gray, he embodied barely there. Yet this forgettability was key to understanding his danger. Arthur grew up with drug-using parents in an arrangement he found cozy, too cozy. After leaving school at 16, he showed no interest beyond watching TV while his mother cooked and cleaned. When she died suddenly, Arthur was unprepared for independence. His brother took him in, but Arthur couldn't grasp that rent was continuous or that chronic lateness might cost his job. When his sister-in-law insisted he leave, Arthur refused. A fight erupted, and Arthur grabbed a kitchen knife, accidentally stabbing his brother in the thigh and nearly severing his femoral artery. Surprisingly, Arthur flourished in prison, enjoying structure, preferring repetitive activities, staying invisible. During a meeting about release, he became terrified and enraged at the mere suggestion. His case reveals how psychopathy can manifest not through calculated manipulation, but through complete inability to function independently, leading to violence when that dependency is threatened. On my first day at a new assessment ward, I met Danny, a frail 18-year-old who collapsed in giggles when the matron playfully feigned a punch. Hours later, he inserted a glass catheter into his penis and broke it in half. Danny entered the system young after his abusive father abandoned the family. Bouncing between foster care and group homes after being trapped in a fire, he joined gangs seeking stability. Without consistent parental figures, he never developed a stable identity. His confusion and rage turned inward through extreme self-harm, leaving intimidating scars that pushed others away. When a local vicar offered stability through church involvement, Danny briefly found purpose. But after perceiving rejection, Danny stabbed the vicar in the back and fled. Sentenced to 10 years, he was transferred to a secure hospital when prison staff couldn't manage his relentless self-mutilation. Danny's case illustrates the complex overlap between borderline personality disorder and psychopathy, where emotional dysregulation meets callousness. These are the heart-sink patients who combine innocence and hope, yet continually sabotage rehabilitation. I met Eddie in a normal London home, not a prison. Now in his 50s, he discussed his violent past and remarkable transformation. His childhood fractured when his mother left for a new boyfriend who became tyrannically abusive. Eddie once grabbed a knife to defend her, only to discover them having sex. What adult Eddie now recognizes was likely rape. His troubles escalated when he attacked a teacher whose finger wagging reminded him of his abuser. Eddie's relationships became toxic, controlling and abusive, while expecting fidelity despite his own infidelity. Despite hating his stepfather, Eddie unconsciously adopted his violent behaviors. After raping a woman, he received a 9-year sentence. At 37, after 2 decades imprisoned, he sought help. Walking London feeling murderous, he noticed people recoiling in fear. Recognizing he'd become everything he hated, he approached a mental health clinic. Weekly therapy transformed his life. After relapsing following his mother's death, he was transferred to a secure hospital with a therapeutic community model. Nearly 20 years later, Eddie has maintained a stable relationship for 9 years. When asked about psychopathy, he explained, "I still get those thoughts, but I push them away. I don't know if you can develop empathy, but I believe I have." Psychopathy isn't an on-off switch. It's a complex interplay of genetics, neuroscience, and environment. Criminal psychopaths never emerge from stable homes. Genetics matter, but environment determines outcomes. The Netherlands Vanderhoeven Clinic demonstrates this. Diagnosed offenders work real jobs, run the cafe, and help manage behavioral issues. Ironically, this therapeutic community model originated at Britain's Henderson Hospital in 1947, but was abandoned in 2008. We invented this effective approach, then forgot it. My research suggests psychopathy isn't even among the top 10 factors predicting violence. The diagnosis describes an absence of empathy while being applied to vastly different individuals, from self-hating young men like Danny to manipulators like Tony to remorseless killers. Psychopathy's origins lie in profoundly wrong early experiences, inadequate parenting, abuse, or insufficient care. Eddie's transformation proves that even those with extensive criminal histories can change with appropriate intervention. The question isn't whether psychopaths can feel, it's whether we're willing to create the conditions that help them learn.